Five Live Football Daily.
Excellent goal by Zaha.
Comes out to Hazard, shoots lights in.
Coutinho strikes it round the wall. Into the corner of the net. Rashford! Rashford finds the back of the net.
He will be a brilliant centre-forward, there's no doubt about that.
He controlled the game, I always found him a very difficult player to play against.
And it's curled in, it's gone all the way in!
Hello, I'm George Riley and welcome to the Five Live Football Daily. In this podcast, I'm joined by the former Scotland, Chelsea and Everton midfielder Pat Nevin, the French football expert Julien Laurent and the journalist Rob Daly for the Monday Nightclub. As the start of the new Premier League season edges closer, we start by looking at who is spending what and the comings and goings at each club.
The Five Live Football Daily Podcast. All the day's football news sent direct to your computer. Podcast it now at bbc.co.uk/5live.
Let's start with this. Manchester City have been spending big yet again. They made Benjamin Mendy the world's most expensive defender after signing the France and Monaco left-back for £52 million. So their summer spending now at City surpasses the £200 million mark, and over 120 of that has been spent on fullbacks. Julien, first of all, are we right to anglicise his name? Is it Benjamin Mendy rather than Benjamin Mondi?
You went out too far, didn't you? Benjamin Mendy. So it's not one of the toughest French names to say. You were quite good. I think if we keep it to Benjamin Mendy more than Benjamin, okay. I think he would like that.
All right. I just had to ask because it's been annoying me all day. What can Manchester City fans expect from him?
Well, very much what they saw when they faced him in the Champions League. I think that really was the time where Pep especially and then Chiqui Begarishan, for example, and people at City saw was how good he was. And I think he had an incredible last 18 months, really, especially the last season with Monaco where I thought he was outstanding. He's still young, he's only 23, and he's got the engine to go up and down his left-hand side through the whole match. Yet, defensively, he needs to improve. There's no doubt. I think he will agree with that as well. He needs more experience, only 4 caps for France, for example. But
in what areas does he need to improve? What are his frailties?
So the positioning, to start with, I think tactically in his positioning, when the ball is on the other side, for example, sometimes he tends to switch off a little bit. But I think Pep can sort that out. I think when he's gone forwards, because the quality of his crossing, for example, is fantastic. But again, when he has to come back to trail back, sometimes, again, he could have some absences that he could often compensate with his pace because he's such a strong and pacey player. But I think tactically, and that's where Pep is going to come, very good for him, is that he still needs to improve a little bit his game.
Rob and Pat, what do we make of this guy? Is he the world's best left-back, let alone defender?
I'd be wary of calling him the best currently. I think Marcelo would try and claim that crown. But when I was actually making a list earlier of world-class left-backs, I couldn't really think of that many. I mean, Marcelo was at the top of the list. Then I thought Jordi Alba, who lost his place at Barcelona in the team last season. And then really getting to the number of someone who is good enough at the Liverpool level Manchester City want to play at, I couldn't really think of too many names. And that's probably why Mondi has partially commanded such a feat. Also that City have exposed themselves in that they arrived into this transfer window with no fullbacks, and the whole market knew it and could charge a fee, as we've seen for Walker and for Mendy.
Don't you just love the fact, as Julien was saying, having watched him quite a bit, that his positional sense isn't great, he can't defend and he doesn't get back? Don't go well for £52 million these days, do you? Which, no, obviously he's young, he's incredibly strong, he's got the power that you talk about as well. He's working under a manager whose first thought is, how are you going to attack? How are you going to hurt other teams? Because if you've got the ball, and Man City, against most of the teams they play against, will have the ball, how are you going to destroy these sort of teams? And, you know, pace all over the field. The great thing about City, in the widest sense, they spent all that time in the first season under Pep there trying to get the forward line, the attacking area sorted out. Right, vaguely got that sorted out. Now look at the kind of defensive wide areas. We'll get that sorted out as well. You think when you're spending, what was it, £135 million in defenders, including a goalkeeper in the last few weeks, you think you should have been able to have sorted it out by now. But I still don't think they have.
I was going to say, they're still going the type of defender they're going for. They're still going for the stylish player rather than that robust, no-nonsense, I'll clean you into the stands defender.
Yeah, and because with Mendy, you will get a lot of great crosses and a lot of great plays going forward and a great movement off the ball going forward again. But defensively, you know, you're not going to see the amazing tackles that, I don't know, Matt Hummels did last season for Bayern when, you know, just avoided that goal or some great positioning play or some great reading of the game. That's not him. So again, yeah, I think I agree with you, Pat, on that one. This is not the kind of player that you could expect to be.
I mean, I love it for the fact. Yeah, I mean, yeah. If I'm a Man City fan or just a football fan who loves watching football, it's going to be a joy to watch. I mean, if he overlaps, how is he going to overlap? Look at the pace in front of him. Because you need to be able to overlap people who are slow enough to let you get by. So, but I just love the fact that Pep's whole attitude is defensive. Is attack, 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 attack. If we score five and you only score four, then so what? We win.
I also like the insight, Rob, you gave into your life and how you spend your time. I spent some time writing a list of left-backs.
It's embarrassing. I mean, I was also looking at stats, actually, about Mendy, and most of them are favourable in terms of attacking play rather than his defensive play, in terms of take-ons of opposition players. Bakayoko, a dynamic midfielder, and Bernardo Silva, who City have also signed, are the only players who have beaten more players than him. And also his crossing statistics are brilliant. We saw his assists against City. So it is bizarre. But if we think back to Guardiola at Barcelona, he crowbarred Mascherano in at centre-back, even though he was a midfielder at Bayern. When he arrived, Martinez was suddenly a centre-back as well. So, you know, he's looking for a lot more.
Can we go back a wee bit there? So his statistics in crossing is absolutely fantastic, yeah.
In terms of decision when to cross and creating an assist, so he doesn't just aimlessly cross it into the penalty area.
Yeah, but how many goals did Man City score from crosses? That's not their exact way, their perfect way to do it. They go through the middle a lot. They generally go in a Barcelona way. I mean, if you look at, he's trying to play a sort of Barcelona way with them. You know, generally you're not getting down the line and putting a cross in the middle. You're actually... Yeah.
But he had fullbacks of Barcelona who were getting behind, didn't he? Dani Alves and Jordi Alba. They're getting to the byline and cutting it back, I suppose, rather than across.
So he's a frustrated wing. He's a frustrated Pat Nevin. Is that what we're saying?
I think if you see him at 6'1", built the way he is, possibly not. But I mean, it's odd though, because there's going to be things that we're going to really enjoy this season, because he's going to come up, if he's attacking in that sort of way, he's going to come up against Jose Mourinho and Manchester United. Now, that's straight back to Barcelona versus Real Madrid and the initial problems that Jose had to kind of fix when he was playing against that team, who had all the ball, but just sent them wide all the time. And then a lot of the time they couldn't destroy that, because send them wide, fine, we'll deal with the crosses.
I should at this point tell you can watch us on the Five Live Facebook page until 8 o'clock if you would so desire. You could pop along just to... give me some feedback on the T-shirt I'm wearing today, which has got mixed reviews in the office. This is what you've been saying on Mendy, by the way. Blue is the colour on the BBC Sport website. Top, top player. Guys at this level don't come cheap. Naz says City are being criticised for being ambitious. It's what you would all want your teams in the transfer market. By any criteria, Mendy, Walker, Danilo, who we'll discuss in a moment, are top players who would expect to command near record fees. You should be looking to your own clubs to react in whatever way they see fit. Can you rise to the challenge? The only team I see stopping City this season are Chelsea. And Darren says we buy defenders to get forward. Mourinho buys forwards and midfielders to defend. I know which I prefer.
My point completely. And I agree with that completely. You know, and what do you prefer and what actually wins things in the end? Well, we're going to find out this season. That's one of the great things about this season. So different from like last season. I think it was a lot of teams which were really in the midst of change.
And that's why we love the diversity of managers we have operating now in the Premier League, because they are after different things.
It's not one methodology and it's not one system. We had this long period there, a long period with 2 or 3, 4 years where it was everyone wanted to play 4-2-3-1 and you think, oh, yawn, can we not move on a little bit? Things have changed. But we're now seeing adaptations to that and it's great.
Rob Danilo then joined from Real Madrid over the weekend. Alexandra Kolarov going to Roma. He can play also in a variety of positions, not just at right fullback.
Yeah, I saw that Pep Guardiola said that when he was asked about whether Kyle Walker should be nervous about competition for place at right back. I'll be honest, I haven't seen Danilo play a great deal of positions other than right back, especially when he's in Portugal and when he went to Real Madrid where he was second choice. I don't think Real Madrid fans are going to be too disappointed to see Danilo leave, especially for the money involved. They definitely preferred Dani Carvajal, who was without question first choice at Real Madrid. I think there's also questions about his defensive positioning. I know he was linked with Juventus and Chelsea as well, so a lot of clubs clearly admired him, but I wonder if that was more due to a lack of world-class right-backs rather than the qualities of Danilo himself.
Did you write a list of right-backs as well?
I didn't do that. Sorry I didn't do that this time.
What else do we know about Danilo Juliet?
No, I agree with a lot of what Rob just said. I think defensively, again, you know, he has issues in his positioning especially, but he's quick and he can compensate that with his pace, and he's quite strong physically as well. He's similar to Mendy in many ways, although not as good, I think, going forward. But it's just, I don't know where the thinking was, the planning more than the thinking about City. Why in the same summer you have to buy two right backs and one left back? Why? I mean, Monaco bought Mendy for 15 million euros, you know, last summer. Where was the planning in terms of City? Even before Pep arrived, what was Chiqui Beguerishtain doing? And how you end up at this time spending all that money on two right backs and a left back is just beyond me.
So, Pat, Manchester City have signed five players. What else do they still need?
I'll be absolutely honest with you. I don't think they've got centre-back sorted yet. So I think they've... Obviously, if Kompany's fit, then fine. All bets off. Wow, what a defence you've got there. And I don't have any problem with John Stones either, you know, and that would be absolutely fine. But I think once you've got... If you put all your eggs in a kind of Kompany basket, you're taking a massive chance there, which is a subject we're going to get up to later. I think there is a centre-back available just now who I think would suit them perfectly. We'll not go into that yet. But I still think he's did exactly the opposite of what most managers do. He's built from the front as opposed to build it from the back. And he's, you know, that's maybe why they were not as successful as they should have been last season in comparison to the amount of money they spent.
Manchester City, by the way, are close now to eclipsing Real Madrid's world record transfer spend by one football club in a single transfer window. This goes back to the summer of 2009 when Real spent £218 million on Ronaldo, Kaká, Benzema, Xabi Alonso, Albaloa, Granero and Raul Albiol, I beg your pardon, as well. Now, let's hear from one of the other new signings, Kyle Walker, who arrives from Spurs for £45 million. He's been explaining what attracted him to Manchester City.
I just think the project that they've got going on, you know, the manager was a big thing for me, that I wanted to come and play underneath him. As I said before, with him working with the likes of Dani Alves and the top players at Barcelona, plus Lahm at, you know, Bayern Munich, that was a big attraction for me. And, you know, I feel that he can give me some knowledge. You know, I'm not saying that, you know, Maurizio Pochettino didn't, because he, you know, catapulted my game. I feel just to get that little bit further, I feel that if I could take the knowledge off of him and come and play with the players that are playing here, it's a great opportunity that I couldn't turn down.
People might be a little bit surprised in the fact that Tottenham have done so well. They've got such a good young team. Finished second in the league last year, got to the FA Cup semi-final. Manchester City didn't do those things. So what's the thought process in leaving Tottenham?
I think just in football, sometimes I've been there for 9 years. This would have been my 9th season there, and sometimes you need to come out of your comfort zone a little bit. Obviously, with trips there, it was, you know, we pushed each other and we played really well. Whoever was there, we was cheering each other on. But when you've been somewhere for 9 years, I feel that I needed a new challenge, and I feel that this was the right club to come and challenge myself, you know, because, you know, the stepping stones that they've made, you know, over the past years is, you know, phenomenal, and I wanted to be a part of it.
You don't think you might be leaving behind what could be a golden era for Tottenham Hotspur?
I hope it is for them, because, you know, they deserve it. The work that the club, the chairman, the manager's put in, you know, so I hope it is for them. But I feel that this was the right step in my career path, you know, for me and my family, to come here and test myself, you know, with the best players, some of the best players in the world.
Could you explain the attraction of working for someone like Pep Guardiola?
I think it says it's all in his name, you know, the clubs that he's worked at, the character, the trophies he's won. You know, I think he says it all about him as a person, and just working with him a few times on the training field, you know, he's really enthusiastic about what he wants to do. You know, he has a plan in his head of where he wants us to be, how he wants us to play. And I think we just all need to buy into that, you know, and I'm sure the trophies will follow.
When you run out on the pitch in a Premier League game, you're going to be a 45 or a 50 million pound player. Does that weigh heavily on you? I mean, it's a huge amount of money.
Yeah, it is. I mean, coming from Sheffield, moving down there when I was 19 to then come back up here, for that amount of money. You know, it's a big fee, but that's nothing to do with me. You know, I've just got to play the game that I play the game that I played in the last two seasons, you know, under Maurizio Pochettino at Tottenham, and, you know, that's what's got me to where I am now. So I don't need to change anything. I just need to add to it and build on it in the right way.
And Manchester City didn't win a trophy last year. Would it be a failure if you don't win a trophy this year?
Well, you know, I feel that with the players that we've got, with the manager that we've got, you know, we need to start picking up silverware, and that's what I've come here for. You know, I was unfortunate at Tottenham that we made it so close. Sometimes it was unlucky, sometimes we just didn't have that little bit of edge. So I'm hoping, you know, with the players that we've got here and the world-class players that we've got here, we can have that edge and go and lift a trophy, which are, you know, what I want to do in my career.
That's Kyle Walker speaking to our reporter Simon Stone, and speaking quite eloquently, I thought, as well. Listening to that on the Monday Night Club, Pat Nevin, Julien Laurent and Rob Daly. So, guys, why is Spurs to Manchester City the right career step for him?
I think Pep is still so attractive to anyone. I mean, Bernardo Silva, when he signed from Monaco, mentioned him. When Mendy signed, he was like, I can't believe I'm going to work with Pep, or for Pep. And just on that, 4 years ago when Mendy signed from Le Havre in the French second division to Marseille, Marcelo Bielsa was the manager in Marseille. Bielsa is Pep's mentor. I don't believe a second that Pep and Bielsa didn't call each other before City signed Mendy. But there's an amazing video that was filmed 3 years ago in Marseille where Bielsa has a few players around him and Mendy is there. And Bielsa couldn't speak French. He had a translator there. And in Spanish, he starts saying, you know, Mendy, you could become one of the best left-back in the world, if not the best left-back in the world. So some of the players in Marseille are a bit laughing. You know, it's a bit... He said, no, I'm serious here. You could become the best in the world. You have to listen. You have to listen to me, but you also have to listen to more experienced players. You need to understand a lot of things, but you could become the best. And Bielsa had an incredible influence on Mendy and other players in Marseille, but especially Mendy. And Mendy is not maybe just yet, as we said, the best left back in the world. Marcelo is probably ahead of him. But with Pep, he really believes he will become the best in the world.
Rob, is this move and indeed some of the other acquisitions from City all about the manager?
I think it's a massive factor. I think the money's a factor as well, obviously, and the opportunity to play. He already had that at Spurs, I suppose, but City should be qualifying for the Champions League season by season and contesting for every single trophy they compete in. And, you know, as you were mentioning Guardiola there, he cultivated probably, I might argue, the best right back of the 21st century in Dani Alves and shaped him into such a sensational player. Walker will be hoping for more of the same. We obviously thought Dani Alves might end up at City, ironically, at one point before he decided to go to Paris Saint-Germain. I think for Walker, you know, maybe as well at the back end of the season, I don't know to what extent he felt completely valued by Tottenham. He was in and out of the team a little bit. I do think he's a better player than Trippier, but it is a very good opportunity for him, especially in a World Cup year.
I wouldn't want to diss Spurs in any way. I mean, in many ways, like
you can do if you like.
No, well, I wouldn't. I can't actually, because I love watching them play. They're a joy to watch playing. They certainly were last season. A joy to watch playing. Kyle Walker's kind of, I'm not going to say, well, he's slightly lucky in the fact that he's just gone from Spurs, which is a team that absolutely suits his style down to the ground, to another team. That absolutely says style right down to the ground. So, yes, he's a good player. If he has got one weakness, and I think we all agree, it's probably one thing. His final ball into the box hasn't been great. You know, it hasn't been maybe not as good as Trippier's.
But that's not lucky, him finding a team that suits his style.
Exactly. That's a good point.
That's why they've come in for him.
That's just pure jealousy in my part, right? Okay, more than that. But, I mean, a lot of the time, if you can be lucky in some ways, like you could end up playing with a team that's more defensive-minded. It might not suit him playing with, say, a Manchester United under Jose quite the same way as it would do a Pep under Manchester City, if you know what I mean. So, he's got two fabulous teams, two fabulous managers, two attack-minded teams to suit a player of his skills.
Charlie on social media says, how can a left-back that has had one good season be worth £52 million? Joke. And Cedric says, is there any point in a youth player joining Manchester City's academy? They will not get a chance of playing in the first team. Pat, there were some interesting comments on this, weren't there, from Gary Neville over the weekend about City failing to give some of their younger players enough opportunities to break into the team. It was Phil Foden, wasn't it, the 17-year-old, who was excellent in the pre-season friendly defeat against Manchester United. United. Neville said on Twitter at the time, he's at the wrong Manchester club for getting a sustained opportunity. City have a lot of great kids, they should be playing. How much of a point does Neville have?
I can see and I can understand the point, but I don't always go along with that. It sounds harsh, and I don't make myself the most popular person with some Chelsea fans who've got the same thing aimed at them all the time. But you know what? If you're good enough, you'll make it. Simple as that. And you look at a lot of young players that go out on loan from the likes of City, from the likes of Chelsea, and I mention those two because they put more out on loan than anyone else. They're always in the Youth Cup finals. They are the most successful too. They put them out on loan and people say, why didn't you try them? Then they go out on loan and they do okay at clubs that are much lower down. In simple terms, if you want to get a game for Manchester City, if you want to get a game for Manchester United, if you want to get a game for Chelsea, you better be one of the best players in the world. It's a big jump to go from under 21s. It's a massive jump. People think it's one jump. It's not. It's a massive jump. So you might have to go via loan at a lower league, via a loan at a lower part of the Premier Division. And when you show all that, then fair enough. And I can just hear Twitter melting down just now shouting, what about Nathan Ake? Good point. I would say good point, because he was maybe the one that slightly disappointed me that he left Chelsea to go to, you know, Bournemouth. Right. And to be fair, £20 million is a lot of money for a guy who...
Well, this is the point, Pat, because football, Robin, Julia, whether we like it or not, is a business. So does it matter if the younger players, the younger British talent, get a game? Because if they do get sold, it's still good business for that club. So they won't care.
It is. The problem is that if then you let one go and you have to spend £100 million to bring him back. Because I'm not sure if Gary Neville agrees that maybe Paul Pogba was in the wrong Manchester club as well in his first spell at the club. Listen, I agree with Pat. At 16 or 17, it's impossible to predict what the kid is going to be 2 or 3 years down the road. It's impossible. And it's great to shine in pre-season. It's great to do well in the under-23 or with the reserves or play with England and 21 or under-20 and win the World Cup. It doesn't mean you can play week in and week out in the Premier League. It's a different level. It's an even different game for most of them. So give them a bit more time. Yeah, let them train with the first team, okay, but can be too impatient.
The most important, I would say, in the midst of this, you have to give them first team football. And that is the one thing that I say is the excuse I would make for all the teams that do this. As long as they loan them out early enough to get them first team football when they're 18, 19, 20, if they don't do that, then I'm going to be the first person to shout them down, because you're spoiling the opportunities for these kids. But if you loan them out, no, you're still getting first team football, that's fine.
If I think to some of England's key players at the moment and their route into the England team and into their first team, Harry Kane got in because I think Roberto Soldado wasn't firing at Spurs and he started to impress in games. We think back to Marcus Rashford, maybe a bit of a happy accident for Manchester United when Van Gaal chucked him in and he scored on his debut a couple of goals in the Europa League. Lallana's had to come back up through the leagues. We've got Raheem Sterling, who played when Liverpool had no one else when he first broke into the team under Rodgers. So I do worry about the opportunities players get. I mean, you see the England team doing so well at what levels this summer? Under 17, under 20, under 19 and 21? I'm worried about what happens to those players, because continually we're not seeing them make it.
It's a problem. It's definitely a problem. But there are answers to that problem, because you must use the loan system. And it isn't perfect. But then again, you don't get the Premier League being this league it is just now, spending all these massive amounts of money, getting all this interest in, unless you get as many of the best players or as many of the most attractive players as possible.
And that's a great point, actually, Rob, on Rashford. That wasn't a case of this kid is ready. That was a case of we have absolutely no other option.
And isn't that a great thing from him to step up in that moment and deliver?
Take a chance. You've got to take a chance. I suppose it's like any player. Take your chance when it comes. And, you know, if you're a youth player and you're playing with Chelsea or Man City or whoever, and that opportunity comes, if you go and score 2 or 3 goals, then you'll probably stay in. But you've got to do brilliantly that first opportunity.
But you need that stroke of luck. Yeah. He has proven that he is good enough for this level. You said if you're good enough, you'll get a game. He didn't get a game because he was good enough. He got a game because he had the stroke of luck and everyone else was out.
And the argument could be 6 months down the line, when Jose Mourinho had watched him enough in training, he might have thought, yeah, he's good enough. Yeah, I'd have spotted that. He would make that argument.
Yeah, exactly. But,
so is there not then an obligation here, if you sense that you have someone in your ranks who might make it, you have to put them in?
I can see that doubt in your question there. There is no way a modern manager, particularly one who's only here for a year, 2 years, whatever, is going to go and put in a young player who isn't as good as the other player that he's got available, when you've got all the pressures of the Premier League. We'd love to say it'd be great for the English game. By the way, we have the same problem in Scotland. But it ain't going to happen, because these guys need to win or else they'll get sacked. There's not even a question about it. They will get sacked. The one guy who seems to be slightly different, I think Jurgen Klopp's a wee bit different.
In what way?
He looks at it in a different way. I think what he did over in Germany, he thought, look, I could go and try and spend as much money as I possibly could, but actually I'd like to work in this group that I've got. And I look at Liverpool and I think, do you know what? He's spent less than I expected, and he's went and got fewer players than I expected, and he's tried to work with what he's got more than most managers do. So I've got a lot of admiration for Jurgen Klopp trying to do it.
Pochettino as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, Pochettino is another one, very much like that. And he said why they've been so quiet in the transfer window this summer is because he would rather promote someone from the youth team maybe and develop him into a much better player, a Premier League player, than go and spend 30 million on Moussa Sissoko.
Julien Laurent, Pat Nevin and Rob Daly with us for the Monday Nightclub tonight. At 9:30 this evening, another chance to hear Chris Froome at the Secret World of Climbing. And on the way, we'll have the latest from Manchester United's pre-season tour, and we will hear from Romelu Lukaku. And Julien will tell you if Neymar is joining Paris Saint-Germain or not.
This is Five Live Sport, the Monday Nightclub.
With me until 9:30, Pat Nevin, French football expert Julien Laurent and journalist and broadcaster Rob Daly, and we're still arguing about how to say Benjamin Mendy. Just remind me.
Benjamin Mendy.
OK, so it's the second bit.
Yeah.
I'll get there eventually. I just want to call him Mondy. I don't know why. Text us 85058. Tweet at 5livesport if you want to get in touch with anything you hear tonight. Now, like Manchester City, Manchester United are currently on tour in the United States. They have won 4 out of 4 in pre-season so far, beating Real Madrid 2-1 in a penalty shootout last night. In the last hour or so, United's new £75 million signing Romelu Lukaku has been speaking to BBC Sports' Simon Stone.
How does it feel to be a Manchester United player? There was a lot of talk about what you were going to do during the summer, where you were going to end up. You've ended up here. How does it feel to be a Manchester United player?
Oh, it feels really great. You know, something that I wanted, always wanted an opportunity to play for a club of this stature, and now I'm here and I want to, you know, to take my chance and, you know, try to deliver as much as I can for the club.
Could you explain what part Paul Pogba played in you being here, because there's a lot of talk about he influenced you, and you've clearly been pictured with him on social media?
No, we were just together on holiday. You know, at the end of the day, I had to make my own choice, and you know, this is really the conversation that I had with the manager that really convinced me the most, the plans and how he wanted to rebuild the club, and he wanted me to be a part of it, so I'm grateful for the chance.
And could you just explain what your aims are this season, what trophies you want to win?
I mean, I don't want to talk about personal ambitions. I just want to work hard on a daily basis and see how far we can get and, you know, win as much games as we can.
That's Romelu Lukaku speaking to the BBC's Simon Stone, who joins us now from Washington, D.C. Simon, one of the key points I thought of that little interview was Lukaku making a point of saying that Jose Mourinho was key, was influential in him signing. And a lot's been made of their previous relationship, hasn't it?
Well, that's right, George. The thing is that when Jose Mourinho was first asked about Romelu Lukaku's signing, he said he was addressing the point that he'd actually sold him to Everton. And he said, I'd never had a problem with Lukaku. But when he says that, people immediately raise an eyebrow and say, well, that can't be right. You don't sell a player and then profess to have a good relationship with him. Clearly, Lukaku is going out of his way to prove that he does have a good relationship with Jose Mourinho. And people that I've spoken to at Chelsea have said it just wasn't the right time. I heard your discussion earlier. Lukaku then wasn't the player that he is now. So Jose Mourinho sold him because he wasn't good enough to play for Chelsea, but he's bought him now because he is good enough to play for Manchester United. And I think it is significant that Lukaku is kind of wanting to bury this myth that he doesn't want to get on. He doesn't get on with Jose Mourinho.
Pat Nevin, did they get on, these two?
I don't think it was a case of getting on or not getting on. It was all about the work rate off the ball. And to watch it was a pre-season game, and he was put on as his big opportunity to work his socks off, and he basically walked about and he got hooked off at half time, and he was loaned out immediately.
So Mourinho
and
thought he was
Mourinho
lazy.
Just said, you got to work. If you're going to get yourself into this team, you got to work. Now, given his due, he was loaning him out at that point in time. So, and Chelsea would want him, because everybody knows if you've got Lukaku, look at his numbers. His numbers are fantastic. He's goal scoring. He's 1 and 2 just about everywhere he's been already at the top level. He's done it in England. He's got the power. He's got the pace. He's got everything you need. Now, you need to put that together in a package with the right attitude that Mourinho wants. He feels as if he can get that now. I don't think he felt as if he could get it then. And that was the problem.
Simon, what's his attitude look like to you out there at Lukaku?
Well, when I was speaking to him an hour ago, he was very laid back, very relaxed, but he looks electric, to be fair, as has Marcus Rashford on this tour. The goal that he scored, Lukaku scored against Manchester City, was fantastic in the sense that it was Pogba's pass. The keeper, Edison, came out. Lukaku beat him to it. But not only did he show the pace to beat him to it, his first touch was fantastic because he just swept the ball almost with his left foot straight into the goal when it looked easier to control it and to try and steady himself. And it's that ability to run the line, it's that ability to create chances out of nothing that Jose Mourinho is buying, because particularly against what I would call the lesser teams in the Premier League, Manchester United had a problem last year. They seemed to get stuck constantly against sides who just defended. And I think Lukaku offers a different focal point. He offers a different way forward. And Mourinho clearly thinks he'll get the goals that will unlock the defences of these lesser teams. And that will propel United up the league.
On social media tonight, at 5 Live Sport or 85058, if you'd prefer to text, David says if Mourinho wanted to be sensible, when's he ever wanted to be sensible? Instead of Lukaku, who would play and create a deadly attacking trio of Martial, Rashford and Lingard. Dean says Lukaku is just a replacement for Zlatan. We need more in attack. And Craig says Lukaku will be the player of the season. Teams will ask a lot of questions and Pogba will give the answers through Lukaku. So watch and learn. We will do that, Craig. Simon, Jose Mourinho says that David De Gea is 100% staying at Manchester United and he's ruled out moves for Bale and for Ronaldo. Has that, do you think, drawn a line under any of those rumours?
Well, I think Jose Mourinho would certainly look a bit silly if any of them came to fruition now. There is a feeling that clearly Cristiano Ronaldo, for all his unease at what happened in Madrid before the Confederations Cup, was only ever going to stay at the Bernabeu. It didn't seem an obvious place for him to go. Gareth Bale, we spoke to very briefly last night after Manchester United had played against Real Madrid in Santa Clara. He wasn't really up for a conversation about his future other than to say, yes, he was staying at Real Madrid. He has always wanted to play for Real Madrid, so there's no suggestion that he wants to move at all. As for De Gea, the feeling is that at some point in his career, He will go back to Madrid. He obviously came to Manchester United from Atletico Madrid, and the feeling is that he will play for Real Madrid at some point in his career. But Real Madrid twice have had the opportunity to buy him, the last two summers. The first time it famously fell through because of this late fax. And last summer, Jose Mourinho said at the weekend that they had the opportunity to buy him and backed away. And I think that is the thing that convinces Jose Mourinho that no deal for David De Gea to go to Real Madrid is going to happen this summer.
Julien, is Anthony Martial doing enough at Manchester United? And am I saying that right?
It's Martial and not Martial. But you're not the only one. A lot of people say Martial.
You don't think I've got a French degree?
No, you don't. Remember those shows we did in Paris through the Euros? That was fantastic. And back then, your French was much better than that, I guess. But
yes, yeah.
I think that what Martial is capable of, for the people who've watched the game against Real Madrid, the goalie setup on that game was simply outstanding. And I think, for me, Jose failed him last season. He failed him because he underused him. He didn't value him enough. Martial is one of those players who need to feel valued and to feel loved. And you might say, he has to grow up, he has to do this. But that's how he works. And I think Jose failed him last season because he could have been much better for United than he was because he felt left apart by Mourinho. I think if Jose and Martial get a very good relationship back on, I think he could be great for United like he was in that Real Madrid game, especially on that fantastic goal that he set up.
So Jose failed Martial. That's intriguing. Martial.
Right, do you know what the problem is? It's like a lot of problem of a lot of these teams just now. You go around looking for the best players in the world and they all happen to be number 10s, right? So you can't stick them all in the same team at the same time. So you stick them out in the left wing. he can't have the same effect. Absolutely nowhere near it. When I watched Martial when he was in France, he was fabulous. His final season in France, he was a joy. He was miles beyond anyone else in the team. And I thought, that guy's going to be fantastic. And then he comes over here and you stick him out left. And you think, well, you're going to get something like 30% less of the ball, and it's not going to come through you. You've only got an angle, having played in that position, you've only got an angle of something like 30 degrees to work with. Whereas if you're playing a 10 or a centre-forward or a ghost centre-forward, which he was doing sometimes as well, you've got everything I've got around you. You've got 360 degrees to work on. So, in short, yeah, to some degree he was failed, but he's not the only one. There's plenty.
On something you mentioned about Lukaku as well, because I wonder, Anthony Martial doesn't always look like the most determined. He can look very relaxed at times and a little bit casual, perhaps. I wonder if that rubbed Mourinho up in the wrong way, in the same way you were talking about Lukaku at Chelsea.
Possibly, and it looks that way sometimes. I don't know if he's necessarily like that, but I think, and also remember, first season, Premier League, it's not always easy. There's a lot of players come in and you think, oh, he came in for a lot of money in your first season or two sometimes if you're a younger player, then it's going to be quite difficult for you, but you can grow into it. Martial won for me. I think he'll be absolutely fantastic.
I remember my hometown club, Leeds United, when they signed Ian Rush and played him right wing, so it does happen.
Gary Lineker is stuck at right wing for Barcelona, didn't he?
That was bizarre things ever. Simon Stone, just before we let you go, just a word on the penalty shootout last night. Was that one of the worst penalty shootouts you have ever seen?
It was the worst penalty shootout I've ever seen, bar none.
What happened?
Ronald McDonald came on at the start of the game. It was a bit weird. He led the teams out. We used to ball boys and mascots leading the teams out. Well, yesterday it was Ronald McDonald. And it felt like, as this penalty shootout shambles was unfolding, that Ronald McDonald was actually taking the penalties because it was 0-0 after two penalties each. 1-1 after three each, and you thought, well, it's going to, you know, it just be a normal shootout now. But then both teams missed again. Daley Blind got the most unconvincing second successful penalty out of five for Manchester United. And then Real Madrid missed again. It was 2-1. After the game, Jose Mourinho said, well, I didn't choose my best penalty takers. You know, it was just a pre-season game. Well, I hope to goodness that he didn't choose his best penalty takers because, quite frankly, I could have gone on there and done better. And I was wearing normal shoes, so, I just couldn't believe it as I was watching it, to be honest.
Distinct lack of Germans available, possibly.
Yeah, maybe that was it. Simon, thanks for coming on tonight. That's the BBC Simon Stone out in America. Maybe that's the way we shake up penalty shootouts. The manager has to nominate the five worst takers.
I think he's draw lots. We're looking at different things with penalties just now to make it fairer. Not doing the ABAB system, doing the ABBA system. Yeah. But, yeah, draw lots. I'm up for that.
One final word on Manchester United, by the way. UEFA have suspended Eric Bailly. How was that?
Perfect.
Good time, lucky. For three games following his sending off against Celta Vigo, he will miss the Super Cup against Real Madrid and Manchester United's first Champions League group game. He's already served one game of that ban against Ajax in the Europa League final. I just have this need to pronounce names in French sometime. On Five Live Breakfast a couple of weeks ago, I just did a Tour de France route name. Yeah. And then my next story was about Bill Beaumont. And I said, Bill Beaumont. For absolutely
that's
no
a
reason.
That's a little bit high, isn't it?
That is brilliant.
Oh, hilarity reigned. Right, the Neymar to Paris Saint-Germain saga took an interesting twist last night when Gerard Piquet, his Barcelona teammate, tweeted a picture of himself and Neymar with the words, is it Sequida?
Sequida.
Okay, I don't think Spanish, so you can let me off. That's Spanish for stays. What's the PSG view on this, Julien?
So he's still, for them, he's still very much on, which will be obviously the transfer of all transfers, you know, the biggest in history by far.
It's transfer, not transfer, by the way.
Transfer, if you want to speak French, but let's keep it English word, transfer. They still believe it's possible. There's reports in France saying that Neymar's player's contract is already ready. That is, the club picked it up from the lawyers. It just needs his signature at the bottom of it, that they're still working on a structure of the deal for the release clause of £197 million, €222 million, which the club is PSG are working really hard on to try to make it the best possible so they could get around financial fair play, because his wages as well would be enormous. We're talking about €30 million euros net after tax, so after tax a year over 5 years. So that's a lot of money we're talking about. And they still believe that he wants to go to Paris, that he feels not valued enough at Barcelona. He realizes that with Messi there, he's not going to win the Ballon d'Or, for example, that he will always play second fiddle to Messi, albeit Messi being the greatest player of all time, maybe. And he wants to be the number one somewhere. There's no Brazilian players left in the dressing room at Barcelona. All his mates are in Paris. Dani Alves, Marquinhos, Lucas Moura, Thiago Silva as well. All of them are there. All of them are telling him, come here. Paris will be yours. This is your team. This will be your club. It'd be fantastic for him. So I think there'd be more twist. And again, this is such a big transfer. It can't be just done like this in a couple of days. You know, it's something that would take a bit more time if it happens. But PSG is still very confident. Well, not very, still confident it could happen.
Or maybe he just wants, he and his agent just want to get a better contract at Barcelona.
Yeah, and that's what happened last year. If I take you back 12 months ago, exactly at this time, PSG thought they had him. They really thought they had him. They worked really hard to get him. And in the end, he signed a new improved deal at Barcelona. So you never know with him and his dad, who is the agent. But this time it feels a bit different on his side, that really he feels that maybe it's the right time for him to leave Barcelona to get to something new where he would be the huge, huge star.
I saw some reports today that Neymar's people were putting it out that they don't know why Gerard Piqué tweeted that, that they weren't really standing by the idea that Neymar was definitely staying at Barcelona. If you negotiate a contract either way, you don't want that kind of information to go out that way. But if we look at Neymar's new deal, I mean, Messi's new deal, which was just signed this summer, Neymar's earning a lot less than him by comparative standards. With this also, it comes back to this individual nature of football a little bit now, that they're saying Neymar wants to go to win the Ballon d'Or, which I don't really understand the obsession with this at the moment anyway. I mean, I think we've only had one French-based winner of the Ballon d'Or ever. Not saying that Neymar couldn't win it there playing in the Champions League, but I don't really understand the playing second fiddle to Neymar, to Messi either.
There is one thing about that I do sort of understand. If you're playing in any team, if you're a footballer, you're only going to get a certain amount of the ball. So I mentioned it earlier on, you're going to get a certain amount of the ball during a game. Now, if you have got a player who is a core player that everything goes through, the amount of ball you're going to get is going to be limited purely by that. You only get a certain amount of chances. Now, look at Neymar's numbers again. His goal scoring has been absolutely brilliant. It's been fine. It's no problem at all. His numbers are actually better for Brazil, where he's the main man. Now, he must look at that and think, there are games where I'm not as involved as I want to be, because it might go to be, you know, it'll go to top players. You know, they've got Messi. He will always get the ball first, and that happens. That's the way it is. But if he can go to another club where he is the core, he is the main, everything goes through him, he thinks he'll get his numbers up again. And I do understand that. It's a bit of a shame because, you know, he's playing with a damn good team. He could be playing with one of the greatest teams ever. He's playing with Messi and enjoy doing that for as long as he possibly can. But there's a bit of me that can see that, you know, I'm actually not getting as much out of myself, and you're not seeing as much of me as you should do, purely because of that.
And Paris Saint-Germain, Julia, how desperate are they to make a mega signing, a world record-breaking signing? And do you think they need to?
Yeah, I think they are desperate, and I think they need to. The idea was always to replace Ibrahimovic last summer with another marquee signing. And they failed on signing Neymar, and they ended up with Jesse, Krikoviak, Ben Arfa, who I love, by the way, but still. And you know, and it was not the transfer window that PSG are used to since the Qatari took over the club and spent all those millions. And it's not the one they wanted for to improve their team, for the standing of their team as well. And they still need the quality of a marquee signing. They need the name of a marquee signing. They also need the attraction in terms of, you know, finances, marketing, merchandising of a marquee signing, which Ibra took away when he left the club. And I think it's very important for the progression of the club, if they want to keep improving under the Qatari ownership, to get that marquee signing as soon as possible.
What about Alexis Sanchez? Because he's been linked as well.
Yeah, he's been linked. And on Friday night, they really thought they could do both. And they still, in a way, believe they could do both Neymar and Alexis, although they realise that, again, it's a lot of money. It looks like Alexis has been quite greedy, might not be the right term, but expensive in what he's asking for. Both him and Fernando Felicevic, his agent, seems to have asked a lot from PSG, and more through the summer as well. So now it looks maybe a bit more unlikely, because Arsene Wenger is also adamant that the player is going to stay. So that's another debate, because I still can't believe you could keep a player who doesn't want to play in a team that doesn't play the Champions League, for example. But PSG, in many ways, still believe that they could do both. And if they can't pull out Neymar, maybe Alexis will be the one.
I mean, you're looking at a situation here, I feel, for Arsenal, where you say, OK, so he's earning roughly £7 million a year and he has a transfer value of, what, 50, 60, who knows, in this market, a lot of money. Are you willing to burn through all that value for one season of him and then see him go? So it's like, is he worth 60 or £70 million for one season? Am I wrong in seeing it that way?
It's the oldest one in the book. In times gone past, you're absolutely right. You must get rid of him. Very rarely you let someone's contract run down like that. And by the way, he might get A, injured in the first game of the season.
Yeah.
B, he might not be up for it the same way as well. There might not be quite the same sort of hunger. Mm. Remember being at the Bayern game away from home over in Munich, and his body language were... He just chucked it by the end of the game. You know, and I couldn't blame him because he was the only player who was actually playing for the vast majority of that game alongside Koscielny. So you're keeping somebody on who actually has no value to you or less value to you than he's ever been. So it makes a good point. I would not be surprised, and I think a lot of people wouldn't be surprised if the last minute he did go.
I mean, I look to Borussia Dortmund in this situation whereby they had to sell players to Bayern and bigger clubs time and time again. Mario Götze departing. And then with Lewandowski, there was a point where they had to say, no, you are going to see out your contract. And they did let a 50, 60 million pound striker go.
I suppose the only place in the world you can do it now is in the Premier League, because there's so much money. Yeah. You could almost... to some degree write it off. It would absolutely break Arsene Wenger's heart to do that, because that's not the person he is. But the only time in history it could be done is in the Premier League.
Imagine as well, so if he stays, let's say he stays, in January he's free to sign for whoever he wants for free. Yeah. He signs for Chelsea on the 1st of January. At the end of the season, Chelsea and Arsenal are fighting to finish fourth. Okay? What is Alexis' interest when the club is going to join, can play the Champions League or not, depending on the club he's at the moment.
He's not going to throw the game, though, is he?
No, he's not. But you see what I mean? How difficult the whole
It'll
thing
be
might
an
be.
Issue in the background, wouldn't it?
There will always be something, potentially, or an injury. Yeah. Like Pat said, what happens if he gets injured in the first of
September?
Because
he's played huge amounts of football, and given his due as a player, his work rate is phenomenal. And he keeps on putting it in for almost every single game, for every single minute. He's a player who never, ever wants to come off either. So put all those things together, and do you know what? He could be an injury waiting to happen. It's a big chance for Arsenal to take.
Pat Nevin, Julien Laurent and Rob Daly on the Monday Night Club. Let's bring in John Cross as well, the Daily Mirror's chief football writer, who's been following Arsenal around China on their pre-season tour. Hi, John.
Hello, very good evening, George. Very good evening, guys.
What do you make of what you've been hearing from the boys tonight?
No, it's interesting on Sanchez, to be honest. I mean, it is this sort of kind of ongoing debate. Do Arsenal sell? Do they cut their losses? And look, I was in Shanghai when Wenger couldn't have been harder. He said that basically he will definitely not leave. They've made a club decision and he will stick to that promise and that he won't be allowed to go. We've seen it before, of course, and someone, you know, rightly asked, well, you know, what happened with Robin van Persie? You said he wouldn't go. And indeed, you know, I was on a tour in 2011 once when he said basically you couldn't possibly sell Nasri and Fabregas in the same summer and be considered to be a big, ambitious club. A few weeks later, they sold them both, you know. So there's no getting away from it that sort of Arsenal do have track record on this. Where it's different this time is that they're in a different financial playground, if you like, Arsenal. They're not under the same financial pressure as they were. The stadium bill has gone down. But what I would say is that I think he's just sort of posturing, really, trying to drive as big a price as he can possibly get, because I do think there's a realisation within the club that he wants to go. He probably will go. It's a deal that might go to the wire, might go to the third week of August or something like that, with PSG and Man City still in the frame. So Arsenal clearly would prefer to sell him abroad. And my heart's telling me that I do think he will leave this summer. I just don't think it'll be sort of, whether it's 50-60, I think it's too much to turn down with a player with 1 year left.
John, you know the big problem with that, of course, is, and it makes perfect sense, and I would be inclined to agree with you, you better have your replacement ready. Do not let it happen that he goes with a couple of days left to go to the transfer window and not have someone else to spend that money on. Because if you make that mistake, that will come back to haunt Arsene Wenger. The fans will not accept that.
Couldn't agree more, Pat. And I do think they've put in a lot of work on Thomas Lemar. I know that Monaco has been like a fire sale. I mean, another one today, Mendy, heard you talking about him earlier, what a player he is. And there's only so many players that you can possibly lose. But I do think Arsenal have got so many players in the squad, though. You know, big earners, big squad players like Gibbs, Debuchy, you know, Jenkinson. You forget them all. They've got to shift some of these guys out. Chambers, another one. They've got so many players on the periphery that I think that basically they've got to balance the books before they can bring in another one. But I think their wish would be is if they could get a deal lined up for Lamar, then they'd part company with Sanchez, I think. And that would be their kind of the dynamic that would tempt them into selling.
I agree with you, John. You know I often do, but I think Lemar, I think Arsene sees Lemar as the replacement for Alexis, although they're two completely different players. But I think that's the idea, and Monaco are pushing the price up for Lemar like they do with all of their players, apart from even, especially Kylian Mbappe, but Lemar as well as Mendy and Bernardo Silva and Bakayoko. And Arsene is trying to do the same with Alexis Sanchez, sorry, to get as much money as possible if they do sell him, to then be able to be in a strong position to get Lemar, who in many ways wants to go to Arsenal as well, but just so far the two bids from Arsenal have been rejected by Monaco.
Yeah, I do think it, Julian. I mean, I think it's one that has got a fair chance of happening. I do think it's a question of can they shift the other players? Can they get it done in time? I mean, Arsenal's dealings in the market in recent seasons haven't been great, have they? But I do think they need to get rid of some of these guys who are sort of hanging around in the shadows a little bit. They need fresh starts. Arsenal need to shake up and streamline the squad. And look, Sanchez is a brilliant, brilliant player, but he is an excitable character. He's a temperamental player. He takes some managing. And I think if they can get Lamar in and Sanchez out for a decent fee, and obviously sell quite a few, I think that Arsenal, that sort of Wenger and the hierarchy will think it's been a very good summer still, even though they lose their star player.
And John, the tour itself, Arsenal's tour of China, what's that been like?
Well, it's been an experience because I had a week first in Sydney, which was mild. It's obviously their winter, and it was quite cold in comparison to sort of generally that time of year. And they played two teams that were really quite poor. You know, the level miles behind, and it was a breeze basically. Then they turned up to Shanghai first and foremost. I mean, as soon as you stepped off the plane, you were hit with a wall of heat. Everything in China is very difficult to do. I think, you know, they make life difficult for people. It's everything in China has to be done just so. And I think it was difficult. I think that some of the players found that they couldn't complete double sessions. Obviously, then they had a sort of a sickness bug. I don't think it was food poisoning. I think it was more of a bug, really. And I think that must be heat connected. And it hit about five or six of the players. It's far from ideal. And look, they went into the games. Obviously, they drew with Bayern Munich and won on penalties. And they were really beaten well by Chelsea, who looked miles ahead. I think just Arsenal was so leggy. And I think by the end of it, the end of sort of two hard weeks, they just found as if they'd run out of gas, really. But I do think they found it was a decent rise. You saw, you know, one or two sort of emerging youngsters come through. Reece Nelson looks really good one for the future. I like the way, really like the way that Giroud, I think he had a really good tour. There's so much speculation about him and whether he'll move on, but he's clearly fighting his place. He did himself a load of credit, I thought. And so you do get quite a lot out of it, but you can't tell me that the players will be anything but shattered this week. I still don't believe that these foreign tours are anything but publicity stunts. And I don't think in terms of pre-season training that they're anything but, I mean, they're far from ideal.
You're telling me, I actually played in Beijing against the Chinese national team on a tour over there. And you know you are not generally there for the football. And even the fitness stuff, you're right. It bears very little relation to the type of fitness that you want for, you know, the top league when you get back. So they'll be desperate to get back into a regime where they actually work in their real fitness.
John, a quick one before you go on Jack Wilshere. Where do we think he will be playing his football next season?
Well, I'd struggle to believe it were Arsenal, George, simply because I do think the club have had a conversation which went along the lines of you can go and find yourself another club. I mean, he can stay at Arsenal. He's got a year left. I personally don't think he will. I think he was brave last summer to go out on loan. I really like Jack Wilshere. I still think it, and I hope he's got a future in the game. injuries have definitely taken their toll, but he needs a fresh start. I think he'll still stay somewhere in the Premier League, but there's been offers from abroad. But I think, I mean, he could take his pick from the likes of, you know, Newcastle, Swansea. I think the big one really is West Ham still in the background. I've got a sneaky feeling he'll end up at West Ham. But I do think he needs a fresh start. Great player, Jack, but I just think he needs to kind of find himself again, hopefully get a run of fitness and games. And I still think he can come back and be a good player for club and country.
Cheers, John. Good to have you
Thank
on.
Thank you.
There's a rumour, by the way, that the Turkish side Antalyaspor have made a move to sign Wilshere, but the club president says Arsenal want a lot for the player.
Yeah, I would be surprised if he went there, if there were other options, certainly in the Premier
League. What kind of fee could Wilshere still command, though, bearing in mind he's always injured?
Well, there's also the fact that when you buy him, you know, how much, you know, fitness are you going to get? And how much certainty are you going to get of that amount of games? So he's in a very difficult position. The last thing that any player wants to be called is, you know, injury prone or anything like that. And that's a problem. So that it's almost impossible to tell his value.
Coming up, we will discuss a lot more with Pat Nevin, Julien Laurent and Rob Daly on the Monday Night Club, including Virgil van Dijk. He couldn't still move to Liverpool, could he?
This is Five Live Sport, the Monday Night Club.
George Riley with you tonight alongside Pat Nevin, French football expert Julien Laurent and the broadcaster and journalist Rob Daly. You can get in touch too. We value your input. 85058, the text number, or you can tweet at 5LiveSport. Now, England are on the brink of qualifying for the quarterfinals of the Women's Euros after last night's 2-0 victory over Spain. Next up on Thursday, they play Portugal in a game you can hear, of course, live on 5Live. They'll reach the last eight if they avoid defeat. We can speak in Holland now to Jonathan Pearce and Rachel Brown Finnis, both part of the 5 Live commentary team. Evening, both.
Hiya, how are you doing?
Good evening, people.
Very good, thank you. Have you dried out yet, first of all?
It was bucketed down yesterday, I can tell you. We got a bit cold and a bit damp, but we were fine, yeah.
Wasn't what we were used to. It's been 30 degrees here before that.
Yeah, sorry
I'm refusing
that.
To believe this. When I was over there with them for the Scotland-England game, I couldn't breathe. It was so hot.
Just for the Scots.
You took the weather with you. We've had rain pouring. It was biblical proportions yesterday.
Rachel, how do you assess the tournament so far for England? Not just the performances, but also the atmosphere around the squad at the moment.
Well, the atmosphere around the squad is one I've never experienced. It really is kind of buzzing. It's assured. It's confident. It's everything positive. And as far as the tournament so far, two sort of contrasting styles of winning a game pretty convincingly, certainly by a scoreline. The opening game against Scotland, you know, as Pat had to endure, was, you know, quite a one-sided affair. But the second game last night against Spain was very, very different.
George, what he's done here in the last 2 years since the World Cup is remarkable, really, Mark Sampson, because they were driven and they were ambitious and they were confident in Canada. But he talks about another quality they have here, and that's the quality of authority. He mentioned that on the eve of the tournament, and that's what he's talking about now, that England have this authority. And the other thing is that while in Canada, they were still largely as a group coach-led and reactive to what he was coaching to them. Now he's got a squad of players who play the game in front of them, can adjust, can react. They did it again last night. They had to against a good French passing team. But they, when all was said and done, and the Spanish outpassed them, they didn't create anything really. And that's all credit to the way that the England players reacted and managed that whole game.
Jonathan, just explain to us, for those who didn't see or listen to the game last night, what happened with the is it a penalty, is it not a penalty decision?
Well, Ellen White was very tired. It was energy-sapping conditions. I don't think she managed to adjust her feet. She slipped. The ball was driven at her. It came off her leg and her hand was very high up behind her head, and the referee gave a penalty immediately. And then several English players went towards her, and reportedly Lucy Bronze said to her, reminded her of the rule whereby if a ball is deflected by a certain part of your body onto your hand, that is no longer classed as a handball decision, and the referee then changed her mind. I still think for that offence, because the hand was so high, a penalty should be given, because I think if it isn't, there's going to be mayhem in the future. And let me just put this to you, George. Had it happened in the other penalty area, what would England have been saying? There would have been a massive stink about it. It's very brave of the referee to make that decision and change her mind. Should she have changed her mind because an England player was talking to her about the rule change? I'm not too sure about that.
It just doesn't happen, does it? It just does not happen. Referees don't change their mind. And if you get in their face, you're more likely to get booked.
Do you know what happened afterwards? And I'll bring Rachel in on this as well. The Spanish queried the decision straight away with the referee, but they talked about it. There was no waving of arms. And once that referee had explained the decision to the Spanish, who would have been incensed by it, there was not a murmur. From that moment in the game, there was not another murmur. And that is one of the features of women's football.
I mean, the way that the England players approached the referee was simply that. They approached them. They weren't gesticulating. They weren't mad. They were very level-headed. They were very calm. And what Lucy and what one of the other players said to us this morning, actually, was that she, you know, had taken notes during the referees' meeting when they come and they address every single squad before the start of the tournament just to explain any kind of intricacies or any slight changes in rules. And Lucy had taken notes as all the girls go into every single meeting they go to with their notebooks. She'd written it down and she said, you know, she needed to learn these rules so that she could apply them appropriately, and she knew exactly what would happen. She knew what a booking exactly was in some maybe slightly unfamiliar or new sort of circumstances. And so she was able to quite calmly relate not advise the referee. I think possibly the referee made the decision in haste, and when she almost replayed it in her mind and was given that gentle reminder by Lucy Bronze, the replay in her head, that gentle reminder, she thought, actually, it probably wasn't a penalty. And, you know, I see it, and yes, I'm an England former player and an England fan, I see it as a very sort of brave and a brave decision, really, where ultimately she took her ego completely out of it, the referee, and she came to the right conclusion.
I think that I totally understand the new application of the law, and that it's been brought in. Referees are now concerned that an innocent deflection of part of the body, if you turn your back, it comes off part of your body and hits your hand, shouldn't be a penalty. I'm absolutely fully in agreement with that. There have been too many penalties given for deflections. But in this particular case, I think there was sufficient gap between the striker of the ball and Ellen's body. It would have been horrible, of all people, for it to happen to Ellen White, because she worked so hard. It would have been appalling for her. But I think, and it wasn't given, and I understand the reasons why it wasn't given, and I applaud the referee for her bravery, but I think in such instances as that penalty decision, I'd say it should have been a penalty.
Do you know, we were talking, Jodie Taylor scored again, didn't she? And once again, Jonathan, you told me, and a number of people had said her movement is absolutely fantastic, and by the way, once again, she showed it was superb again. So, and I remember applauding you in 5 Live, but I'm going to disagree with you. I think the referee was nailed on there. That was not a penalty kick. There's nothing you can do. First rule of the penalty kick, and it's no change from the rules. It's no real change. It's a change in emphasis only.
That's right, yeah.
The number one line is it has to be deliberate handball. Yeah. There is no way in the world, if you try and kick a ball and it spins off a skiddy surface and hits your hand, there's no way that can be. Messi couldn't do that if he tried. So it's not deliberate. I absolutely wouldn't have
given
it.
It just shows you the potential problems that they're going to have with interpreting this law. All I will hope is that players who will be part of a potential, really kind of game-changing moment will act and conduct themselves as the England players did.
What we're hiding the fact here is we're not talking about male football here, are we? The chances of that happening in the men's game is absolutely no chance of people going, I say, old chap, could you have a look at that again? You know, and that has been one of the real joys of these Euros, isn't it?
Yeah.
The fact it has been played in such a phenomenally sportsmanlike way.
But also, it has to be said that England had what should have been a good goal by Millie Bright, struck off with a wrongful decision, which was for offside, by the way, against her. And there was sort of debate whether or not it was for Lucy Bronze closing in, but I think it was definitely
great header
Millie
as
Bright.
Well,
it was
it?
A fantastic header, and she was superb, Millie Bright. And that's why England won the game, you know, because of Millie Bright, and because of Steph Horton at the back, and because of the work rate, and because of Jade Moore, who doesn't get any sort of recognition that she should do. And this is a great unit they have here.
Was Lucy Bronze as good in this game as she was against Scotland? Because I thought she was world class against Scotland.
No, it was a very different game for Lucy Bronze and for Demi Stokes, who certainly neither of them had any tiny bit of freedom to bomb up and down their respective wings in this game. They had to do a job on their counterparts, really. Spain changed their formation from their first game against Portugal and actually started as kind of a 3-5-2, and we expected that really to be a 5-3-2. But they didn't. They did play with Corredera down the right-hand side, who was a substitute from their only change from the first game. And they took the game to England and they pinned back Lucy Bronze and Demi Stokes. So it really brought out the defending calibre of the England team, you know, especially highlighting the likes of Lucy Bronze and Demi Stokes, who were more seen as attacking fullbacks. They really had to show their colours, earn their stripes, really, last night as defenders first and foremost, because they didn't have that opportunity.
Rachel, do England, to you, look technically good enough to go on and win this tournament? They only had 22% possession last night.
Well, I think England certainly played to their strengths. It wasn't... Jonathan's talked about ownership on the pitch and sort of seeing what you play. But this team were very, very well drilled, were very well rehearsed in a game plan that they had to play against Spain, specifically for the Spain game. They've watched hours and hours of video of Spain playing. And what they've seen is that they have a lot of possession. But if you can get them to keep that possession in their defending third and the midfield third, they won't get the opportunity to hurt you. And that's what England set out to do. They played with two holding midfielders in front of the back four. They consolidated and made it two banks of four when they were defending. They put, in the second half, Frank Kirby on one of the really dangerous players, Mete Gert, who was causing England problems in the top of midfield. And they were very, very competent in fulfilling that job. We were always going to relinquish percentage possession to Spain. So if you're talking about technical ability and being able to outpass Spain, no, they won't be able to ever beat that. But they know what they're absolutely excellent at, which is clinical finishing and wonderful defending as a team. And that is where they could win the Euros.
Who are the main rivals, Jonathan, if England can't win it?
Well, I think yesterday was a dress rehearsal for the final. I really do. France haven't got going yet, but, you know, England is scheduled to meet them later on. They've got some wonderful players. The Sommer on the left-hand side who can play through the middle. Tinny, they've got some... Henri scored a good goal the other night with a head. They've got some wonderful players. Germany, if they can get Marizan into top gear, they've got pedigree. But they haven't really performed here. And the former manager, Sylvia Knight, is in our hotel in Utrecht, and she doesn't look particularly happy when she's watching games at the moment. She's sort of had a knack of not looking particularly happy games throughout her career. But anyway, at the moment, she doesn't look particularly joyous. And I think England are right there. I really do. I think Spain are a terrific team, a really, really good team. And England beat them when all is said and done by 2-0. And I think that was absolutely crucial. It would be handy if England could avoid France or Germany before the final. That might not happen now, but I think, George, I honestly do. You know, I'm not just saying it because I'm English. I think they've got and I was there in Canada 2 years ago and I thought they were very strong. I think they're 25% better than they were 2 years ago.
England will be in the position, actually, because they're in the final group, they'll be in the position of having everyone else completed the group stages and knowing exactly kind of whether it'd be preferable, really, in some ways, to finish top of the group or, you know, almost come a tactical second. So I suppose that could potentially be some advantage that they'll have the full picture going into that last game.
Rachel, we'll let you go. Jonathan, we're going to get a bit more work out of you for the next few minutes. I want to ask you about West Ham. Pat, a word on Scotland, though. They were beaten by Portugal. They have a slim, very slim chance of progressing. How impressed were you with though?
Well, this is Scotland's, you know, first opportunity to play in this level of tournament. And they've had to do it with their best players unavailable to them. And like, you know, the men's team, Scotland haven't got that depth of players, and take two, three, and now your centre-forward's out of the game. It's Jane Ross unavailable for the rest of the games and certainly in the next game as well. It's a lot to ask of Scotland. Now probably looking upon it as a learning process. They won't give up, but for Scotland to do well in these competitions, they need everyone available, and the likes of Jen Beattie not being available has just been too hard.
You can hear the England-Portugal game, by the way, on Thursday on 5 Live Sport. So West Ham will have a new-look strike force next season. They've signed Marco Arnautovic from Stoke for a club record fee of £20 million and have agreed a £16 million deal for Javier Hernandez. Jonathan Pearce, are these good acquisitions?
Well, Arnautovic on his day is scintillating, isn't he? What did he score? 26 goals in his